This is Audible.
Penguin Random House Audio presents The Death of Truth, Notes on Falsehood in the Age of Trump by Michiko Kakutani. Read by Tavia Gilbert.
For journalists everywhere, working to report the news. Introduction. Two of the most monstrous regimes in human history came to power in the 20th century, and both were predicated upon the violation and despoiling of truth, upon the knowledge that cynicism and weariness and fear can make people susceptible to the lies and false promises of leaders bent on unconditional power. As Hannah Arendt wrote in her 1951 book, The Origins of Totalitarianism, the ideal subject of totalitarian rule is not the convinced Nazi or the convinced communist, but people for whom the distinction between fact and fiction, in other words, the reality of experience, and the distinction between true and false, in other words, the standards of thought, no longer exist. What's alarming to the contemporary reader is that Arendt's words increasingly sound less like a dispatch from another century than a chilling mirror of the political and cultural landscape we inhabit today, a world in which fake news and lies are pumped out in industrial volume by Russian troll factories, emitted in an endless stream from the mouth and Twitter feed of the President of the United States, and sent flying across the world through social media accounts at lightning speed. Nationalism, tribalism, dislocation, fears of social change, and the hatred of outsiders are on the rise again, as people, locked in their partisan silos and filter bubbles, are losing a sense of shared reality and the ability to communicate across social and sectarian lines. This is not to draw a direct analogy between today's circumstances and the overwhelming horrors of the World War II era, but to look at some of the conditions and attitudes, what Margaret Atwood has called the danger flags in Orwell's 1984 and Animal Farm, that make a people susceptible to demagoguery and political manipulation, and nations easy prey for would-be autocrats. To examine how a disregard for facts, the displacement of reason by emotion, and the corrosion of language are diminishing the very value of truth, and what that means for America and the world. The historian knows how vulnerable is the whole texture of facts in which we spend our daily life, Arendt wrote in a 1971 essay, Lying in Politics. It is always in danger of being perforated by single lies, or torn to shreds by the organized lying of groups, nations, or classes, or denied and distorted, often carefully covered up by reams of falsehoods, or simply allowed to fall into oblivion. Facts need testimony to be remembered, and trustworthy witnesses to be established, in order to find a secure dwelling place in the domain of human affairs. The term truth decay, used by the Rand Corporation to describe the diminishing role of facts and analysis in American public life, has joined the post-truth lexicon that includes such now familiar phrases as fake news and alternative facts. And it's not just fake news, either. It's also fake science, manufactured by climate change deniers and anti-vaxxers, fake history, promoted by Holocaust revisionists and white supremacists, fake Americans on Facebook, created by Russian trolls, and fake followers and likes on social media, generated by bots. Trump, the 45th president of the United States, lies so prolifically and with such velocity that the Washington Post calculated that he'd made 2,140 false or misleading claims during his first year in office, an average of nearly 5.9 a day. His lies, about everything from the investigations into Russian interference in the election to his popularity and achievements to how much TV he watches, are only the brightest blinking red light of many warnings of his assault on democratic institutions and norms. He routinely assails the press, the justice system, the intelligence agencies, the electoral system, and the civil servants who make our government tick. Nor is the assault on truth confined to the United States. Around the world, waves of populism and fundamentalism are elevating appeals to fear and anger over reasoned debate, eroding democratic institutions, and replacing expertise with the wisdom of the crowd. False claims about the UK's financial relationship with the EU, emblazoned on a Vote Leave campaign bus, helped swing the vote in favor of Brexit, and Russia ramped up its sowing of disinformatia in the run-up to elections in France, Germany, the Netherlands, and other countries in concerted propaganda efforts to discredit and destabilize democracies. Pope Francis reminded us, "There is no such thing as harmless disinformation. Trusting in falsehood can have dire consequences." Former President Barack Obama observed that one of the biggest challenges we have to our democracy is the degree to which we do not share a common baseline of fact. People today are operating in completely different information universes. And the Republican Senator Jeff Flake gave a speech in which he warned that 2017 was a year which saw the truth, objective, empirical, evidence-based truth, more battered and abused than any other in the history of our country, at the hands of the most powerful figure in our government. How did this happen? What are the roots of falsehood in the Trump era? How did truth and reason become such endangered species? And what does their impending demise portend for our public discourse and the future of our politics and governance? That is the subject of this book. It's easy enough to see Trump, a candidate who launched his political career on the original sin of birtherism, as a black swan who ascended to office because of a perfect storm of factors, a frustrated electorate still hurting from the backwash of the 2008 financial crash, Russian interference in the election, and a deluge of pro-Trump fake news stories on social media. A highly polarizing opponent who came to symbolize the Washington elite that populists decried, and an estimated $5 billion in free campaign coverage from media outlets obsessed with the views and clicks that the former reality TV star generated. If a novelist had concocted a villain like Trump, a larger-than-life, over-the-top avatar of narcissism, mendacity, ignorance, prejudice, boorishness, demagoguery, and tyrannical impulses, not to mention someone who consumes as many as a dozen Diet Cokes a day, she or he would likely be accused of extreme contrivance and implausibility. In fact, the President of the United States often seems less like a persuasive character than some manic cartoon artist's mashup of Ubu Wa, Triumph the Insult comic dog, and a character discarded by Molière. But the more clownish aspects of Trump the personality should not blind us to the monumentally serious consequences of his assault on truth and the rule of law, and the vulnerabilities he has exposed in our institutions and digital communications. It is unlikely that a candidate who had already been exposed during the campaign for his history of lying and deceptive business practices would have gained such popular support, were portions of the public not somehow blasé about truth-telling, and were there not more systemic problems with how people get their information and how they've come to think in increasingly partisan terms. With Trump, the personal is political, and in many respects, he is less a comic book anomaly than an extreme, bizarro world apotheosis of many of the broader, intertwined attitudes undermining truth today, from the merging of news and politics with entertainment, to the toxic polarization that's overtaken American politics, to the growing populist contempt for expertise. These attitudes, in turn, are emblematic of dynamics that have been churning beneath the surface of daily life for years, creating the perfect ecosystem in which Veritas, the goddess of truth, as she was depicted by Goya in a famous print titled Truth Has Died, could fall mortally ill. For decades now, objectivity, or even the idea that people can aspire toward ascertaining the best available truth, has been falling out of favor. Daniel Patrick Moynihan's well-known observation, "Everyone is entitled to his own opinion, but not to his own facts," is more timely than ever. Polarization has grown so extreme that voters in red state America and blue state America have a hard time even agreeing on the same facts. This has been going on since a solar system of right-wing news sites orbiting around Fox News and Breitbart News consolidated its gravitational hold over the Republican base, and it's been exponentially accelerated by social media, which connects users with like-minded members and supplies them with customized news feeds that reinforce their preconceptions, allowing them to live in ever narrower, windowless silos. For that matter, relativism has been ascendant since the culture wars began in the 1960s. Back then, it was embraced by the new left, eager to expose the biases of Western bourgeois male-dominated thinking, and by academics promoting the gospel of postmodernism, which argued that there are no universal truths, only smaller personal truths, perceptions shaped by the cultural and social forces of one's day. Since then, relativistic arguments have been hijacked by the populist right, including creationists and climate change deniers, who insist that their views be taught alongside science-based theories. Relativism, of course, synced perfectly with the narcissism and subjectivity that had been on the rise, from Tom Wolfe's me decade on through the selfie age of self-esteem. No surprise, then, that the Rashomon effect, the point of view that everything depends on your point of view, has permeated our culture, from popular novels like Fates and Furies to the television series The Affair, which hinge upon the idea of competing realities or unreliable narrators. I've been reading and writing about many of these issues for nearly four decades, going back to the rise of deconstruction and battles over the literary canon on college campuses. Debates over the fictionalized retelling of history in movies like Oliver Stone's JFK and Catherine Bigelow's Zero Dark Thirty, efforts made by both the Clinton and Bush administrations to avoid transparency and define reality on their own terms, Donald Trump's war on language and efforts to normalize the abnormal, and the consequences that technology has had on how we process and share information. In these pages, I hope to draw upon my readings of books and current events to connect some of the dots about the assault on truth and situate them in context with broader social and political dynamics that have been percolating through our culture for years. I also hope to highlight some of the prescient books and writings from the past that shed light on our current predicament. Truth is a cornerstone of our democracy. As the former Acting Attorney General Sally Yates has observed, truth is one of the things that separates us from an autocracy. We can debate policies and issues, and we should, but those debates must be based on common facts, rather than raw appeals to emotion and fear through polarizing rhetoric and fabrications. Not only is there such a thing as objective truth, failing to tell the truth matters. We can't control whether our public servants lie to us, but we can control whether we hold them accountable for those lies, or whether, in either a state of exhaustion or to protect our own political objectives, we look the other way and normalize an indifference to truth. 1. The decline and fall of reason. This is an apple. Some people might try to tell you that it's a banana. They might scream banana, banana, banana over and over and over again. They might put banana in all caps. You might even start to believe that this is a banana. But it's not. This is an apple. CNN commercial, showing a photograph of an apple. In his 1838 Lyceum address, a young Abraham Lincoln spoke to his concern that as memories of the Revolution receded into the past, the nation's liberty was threatened by a disregard for the government's institutions, which protect the civil and religious liberties bequeathed by the founders. To preserve the rule of law and prevent the rise of a would-be tyrant who might spring up amongst us, sober reason, cold, calculating, unimpassioned reason, would be required. To remain free to the last, he exhorted his audience, reason must be embraced by the American people, along with sound morality, and, in particular, a reverence for the Constitution and laws. As Lincoln well knew, the founders of America established the young republic on the Enlightenment principles of reason, liberty, progress, and religious tolerance. And the constitutional architecture they crafted was based on a rational system of checks and balances to guard against the possibility, in the words of Alexander Hamilton, of a man unprincipled in private life and bold in his temper, one day arising who might mount the hobby horse of popularity and flatter and fall in with all the nonsense of the zealots of the day, in order to embarrass the government and throw things into confusion that he may ride the storm and direct the whirlwind. The system was far from perfect, but it has endured for more than two centuries thanks to its resilience and capacity to accommodate essential change. Leaders like Lincoln, Martin Luther King Jr., and Barack Obama viewed America as a work in progress, a country in the process of perfecting itself. And they tried to speed that work, mindful, in the words of Dr. King, that progress is neither automatic nor inevitable, but requiring of continuous dedication and struggle. What had been achieved since the Civil War and the Civil Rights Movement was a reminder of all the work yet to be done, but also a testament to President Obama's faith that Americans can constantly remake ourselves to fit our larger dreams, and the Enlightenment faith in what George Washington called the great experiment entrusted to the hands of the American people. Alongside this optimistic vision of America as a nation that could become a shining city upon a hill, there's also been a dark, irrational counter-theme in U.S. history, which has now reasserted itself with a vengeance, to the point where reason not only is being undermined, but seems to have been tossed out the window, along with facts, informed debate, and deliberative policymaking. Science is under attack, and so is expertise of every sort, be it expertise in foreign policy, national security, economics, or education. Philip Roth called this counter-narrative the indigenous American berserk, and the historian Richard Hofstadter famously described it as the paranoid style, an outlook animated by heated exaggeration, suspiciousness, and conspiratorial fantasy, and focused on perceived threats to a nation, a culture, a way of life. Hofstadter's 1964 essay was spurred by Barry Goldwater's campaign and the right-wing movement around it, just as his 1963 book, Anti-Intellectualism in American Life, was conceived in response to Senator Joseph McCarthy's notorious witch hunts and the larger political and social backdrop of the 1950s. Goldwater lost his presidential bid, and McCarthyism burned itself out after a lawyer for the U.S. Army, Joseph Welch, had the courage to stand up to McCarthy. "Have you no sense of decency, sir, at long last?" Welch asked. "Have you left no sense of decency?" The venomous McCarthy, who hurled accusations of disloyalty throughout Washington, "The State Department harbors a nest of communists and communist sympathizers," he warned President Truman in 1950, was rebuked by the Senate in 1954, and with the Soviets' launch of Sputnik in 1957, the menacing anti-rationalism of the day began to recede, giving way to the space race and a concerted effort to improve the nation's science programs. Hofstadter observed that the paranoid style tends to occur in episodic waves. The anti-Catholic, anti-immigrant, Know-Nothing Party reached its height in 1855, with 43 members of Congress openly avowing their allegiance. Its power quickly began to dissipate the following year, after the party split along sectional lines, though the intolerance it embodied would remain, like a virus, in the political system, waiting to reemerge. In the case of the modern right wing, Hofstadter argued that it tended to be mobilized by a sense of grievance and dispossession. "America has been largely taken away from them," he wrote, "and they may feel that they have no access to political bargaining or the making of decisions." In the case of millennial-era America, and much of Western Europe too, These were grievances exacerbated by changing demographics and changing social mores that had made some members of the white working class feel increasingly marginalized. By growing income inequalities accelerated by the financial crisis of 2008, and by forces like globalization and technology that were stealing manufacturing jobs and injecting daily life with a new uncertainty and angst. Trump and nationalist anti-immigrant leaders on the right in Europe, like Marine Le Pen in France, Geert Wilders in the Netherlands, and Matteo Salvini in Italy, would inflame these feelings of fear and anger and disenfranchisement, offering scapegoats instead of solutions, while liberals and conservatives, worried about the rise of nativism and the politics of prejudice, warned that democratic institutions were coming under growing threat. Yeats's poem, The Second Coming, written in 1919 amid the wreckage of World War I, experienced a huge revival in 2016. Quoted in news articles, more in the first half of that year than it had been in 3 decades, as commentators of all political persuasions invoked its famous lines. Things fall apart. The center cannot hold. Mere anarchy is loosed upon the world. The assault on truth and reason that reached fever pitch in America during the first year of the Trump presidency had been incubating for years on the fringe right. Clinton haters who were manufacturing nutty accusations about the death of Vince Foster in the 1990s, and Tea Party paranoids who claimed that environmentalists wanted to control the temperature of your home and the color of cars you can buy, hooked up, during the 2016 campaign, with Breitbart bloggers and alt-right trolls. And with Trump's winning of the Republican nomination and the presidency, the extremist views of his most radical supporters, their racial and religious intolerance, their detestation of government, and their embrace of conspiracy thinking and misinformation, went mainstream. According to a 2017 survey by the Washington Post, 47% of Republicans erroneously believe that Trump won the popular vote. 68% believe that millions of illegal immigrants voted in 2016. And more than half of Republicans say they would be okay with postponing the 2020 presidential election until such problems with illegal voting can be fixed. Another study conducted by political scientists at the University of Chicago showed that 25% of Americans believe that the 2008 crash was secretly orchestrated by a small cabal of bankers. 19% believe that the U.S. government had a hand in the 9/11 terrorist attacks, and 11% even believe a theory made up by the researchers that compact fluorescent light bulbs were part of a government plot to make people more passive and easy to control. Trump, who launched his political career by shamelessly promoting birtherism, and who has spoken approvingly of the conspiracy theorist and shock jock Alex Jones, presided over an administration that became, in its first year, the very embodiment of anti-Enlightenment principles, repudiating the values of rationalism, tolerance, and empiricism in both its policies and its modus operandi, a reflection of the Commander-in-Chief's erratic, impulsive decision-making style based not on knowledge, but on instinct, whim, and preconceived, and often delusional, notions of how the world operates. Trump made no effort to rectify his ignorance of domestic and foreign policy when he moved into the White House. His former chief strategist, Stephen Bannon, has said that Trump only reads to reinforce, and the president has remained determined to deny, diminish, or downplay intelligence concerning Russian interference in the 2016 election. Because such mentions tend to draw his ire and can disrupt his intelligence briefings, officials told the Washington Post that they sometimes included this material only in written versions of the president's daily brief, which he reportedly, rarely, if ever, reads. Instead, the president seems to prefer getting his information from Fox News, in particular, the sycophantic morning show Fox and Friends, and from sources like Breitbart News and the National Enquirer. He reportedly spends as much as 8 hours a day watching television, a habit that could not help but remind many readers of Chauncey Gardner, The TV-addicted gardener who becomes a celebrity and rising political star in Jerzy Kaczynski's 1970 novel Being There. Vice News also reported that Trump received a folder twice a day filled with flattering clips, including admiring tweets, transcripts of fawning TV interviews, praise-filled news stories, and sometimes just pictures of Trump on TV looking powerful. Such absurd details are unnerving rather than merely comical, because this is not simply a Twilight Zone case of one fantasist living in a big White House in Washington, D.C. Trump's proclivity for chaos has not been contained by those around him, but has instead infected his entire administration. He asserts that "I'm the only one that matters" when it comes to policymaking, and given his disdain for institutional knowledge, he frequently ignores the advice of cabinet members and agencies when he isn't cutting them out of the loop entirely. Ironically, the dysfunction that these habits fuel tends to ratify his supporters' mistrust of Washington, one of the main reasons they voted for Trump in the first place, creating a kind of self-fulfilling prophecy, which in turn breeds further cynicism and a reluctance to participate in the political process. A growing number of voters feel there is a gross disconnect between their views and government policies. Common sense policies like mandatory background checks for gun purchases, supported by more than 9 out of 10 Americans, have been stymied by Congress, which is filled with members who rely on donations from the NRA. 87% of Americans said in a 2018 poll that they believe Dreamers should be allowed to stay in the states, and yet DACA has remained a political football. And 83% of Americans, including 75% of Republicans, say they support net neutrality, which was overturned by Trump's FCC. The declining role of rational discourse and the diminished role of common sense and fact-based policy hardly started with Donald J. Trump. Rather, he represents the culmination of trends diagnosed in prescient books by Al Gore, Farhad Manjoo, and Susan Jacoby, published nearly a decade before he took up residence at 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue. Among the causes of this decline, Jacoby, the age of American unreason, cited an addiction to infotainment, the continuing strength of religious fundamentalism, the popular equation of intellectualism with a liberalism supposedly at odds with traditional American values, and an education system that does a poor job of teaching not only basic skills, but the logic underlying those skills. As for Gore, the assault on reason, he underscored the ailing condition of America as a participatory democracy, low voter turnout, an ill-informed electorate, campaigns dominated by money and media manipulation, and the persistent and sustained reliance on falsehoods as the basis of policy, even in the face of massive and well-understood evidence to the contrary. At the forefront of Gore's thinking was the Bush administration's disastrous decision to invade Iraq and its cynical selling of that war to the public, distorting America's political reality by creating a new fear of Iraq that was hugely disproportionate to the actual danger posed by a country that did not attack the United States on 9/11 and lacked the terrifying weapons of mass destruction that Administration hawks scared Americans into thinking it possessed. Indeed, the Iraq War remains a lesson in the calamities that can result when momentous decisions that affect the entire world are not made through a rational policymaking process and the judicious weighing of information and expert analysis, but are instead fueled by ideological certainty and the cherry-picking of intelligence to support preconceived idée fixes. From the start, administration hawks led by Vice President Dick Cheney and Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld pressed for forward-leaning intelligence that would help make the case for war. A shadowy operation called the Office of Special Plans was even set up at the Defense Department. Its mission, according to a Pentagon advisor quoted by Seymour M. Hersh in The New Yorker, was to find evidence of what Rumsfeld and Deputy Secretary of Defense Paul Wolfowitz already believed to be true, that Saddam Hussein had ties to Al-Qaeda, and that Iraq possessed a huge arsenal of biological, chemical, and possibly nuclear weapons. Meanwhile, planning for the war on the ground ignored sober warnings from experts, like the Army Chief of Staff Eric K. Shinseki, who testified that post-war Iraq would require something on the order of several hundred thousand soldiers. His recommendation was quickly shot down, as were reports from the Rand Corporation and the Army War College, both of which also warned that post-war security and reconstruction in Iraq would require a large number of troops for an extended period of time. These assessments went unheeded, with fateful consequences, because they did not mesh with the administration's willfully optimistic promises that the Iraqi people would welcome American troops as liberators, and that resistance on the ground would be limited. A cakewalk, as one Rumsfeld ally put it. The failure to send enough troops to secure the country and restore law and order, the sidelining of the State Department's Future of Iraq project because of tensions with the Pentagon, the ad hoc decisions to dissolve the Iraqi army, and to ban all senior members of the Ba'ath Party. Such disastrous and avoidable screw-ups resulted in a bungled American occupation that one soldier, assigned to the Coalition Provisional Authority, memorably described as pasting feathers together, hoping for a duck. In fact, the Iraq War would prove to be one of the young century's most catastrophic events, exploding the geopolitics of the region and giving birth to ISIS, and a still unspooling set of disasters for the people of Iraq, the region, and the world. Although Trump frequently criticized the decision to invade Iraq during the 2016 campaign, his White House has learned nothing from the Bush administration's handling of that unnecessary and tragic war. Instead, it has doubled down on reverse-engineered policymaking and the repudiation of experts. For instance, the State Department has been hollowed out as a result of Steve Bannon's vow to fight for the deconstruction of the administrative state, and the White House's suspicion of deep state professionals. The president's son-in-law, Jared Kushner, a 36-year-old real estate developer with no government experience, was handed the Middle East portfolio, while the shrinking State Department was increasingly sidelined. Many important positions stood unfilled at the end of Trump's first year in office. This was partly because of downsizing and dereliction of duty, partly because of a reluctance to appoint diplomats who expressed reservations about the president's policies, as in the case of the crucial role of ambassador to South Korea, and partly because of the exodus of Foreign Service talent from an agency that, under new management, no longer valued their skills at diplomacy, policy knowledge, or experience in far-flung regions of the world. Combined with Trump's subversion of longtime alliances and trade accords, and his steady undermining of democratic ideals, the carelessness with which his administration treated foreign policy led to world confidence in U.S. leadership plummeting in 2017 to a new low of 30%, below China and just above Russia, according to a Gallup poll. In some respects, the Trump White House's disdain for expertise and experience reflected larger attitudes percolating through American society. In his 2007 book, The Cult of the Amateur, the Silicon Valley entrepreneur Andrew Keen warned that the Internet not only had democratized information beyond people's wildest imaginings, but also was replacing genuine knowledge with the wisdom of the crowd, dangerously blurring the lines between fact and opinion, informed argument, and blustering speculation. A decade later, the scholar Tom Nichols wrote in The Death of Expertise that a willful hostility toward established knowledge had emerged on both the right and the left, with people aggressively arguing that every opinion on any matter is as good as every other. Ignorance now was fashionable. If citizens do not bother to gain basic literacy in the issues that affect their lives, Nichols wrote, they abdicate control over those issues whether they like it or not, And when voters lose control of these important decisions, they risk the hijacking of their democracy by ignorant demagogues, or the more quiet and gradual decay of their democratic institutions into authoritarian technocracy. The Trump White House's preference for loyalty and ideological lockstep over knowledge is on display throughout the administration. Unqualified judges and agency heads were appointed because of cronyism, political connections, or a determination to undercut agencies that stood in the way of Trump's massive deregulatory plans benefiting the fossil fuel industry and wealthy corporate donors. Rick Perry, who was famous for wanting to abolish the Department of Energy, was named to head it, presiding over cutbacks to renewable energy programs. And the new EPA head, Scott Pruitt, who had repeatedly sued the Environmental Protection Agency over the years, swiftly began dismantling and slow-walking legislation designed to protect the environment. The public, which opposed the GOP tax bill and worried that its health care would be taken away, was high-handedly ignored when its views failed to accord with Trump administration objectives or those of the Republican Congress. And when experts in a given field, like climate change, fiscal policy, or national security, raised inconvenient questions, they were sidelined. Or worse. This, for instance, is what happened to the Congressional Budget Office, created decades ago as an independent, nonpartisan provider of cost estimates for legislation, when it reported that a proposed GOP healthcare bill would leave millions more uninsured. Republicans began attacking the agency. Not just its report, but its very existence. Trump's director of the Office of Management and Budget, Mick Mulvaney, asked whether the CBO's time had come and gone, and other Republicans proposed slashing its budget and cutting its staff of 235 by 89 employees. For that matter, the normal machinery of policymaking and the normal process of analysis and review were routinely circumvented by the Trump administration, which violated such norms with knee-jerk predictability. Many moves were the irrational result of a kind of reverse engineering, deciding on an outcome the White House or the Republican Congress wanted, then trying to come up with rationales or selling points afterward. This was the very opposite of the scientific method, whereby data is systematically gathered and assessed to formulate and test hypotheses, a method the administration clearly had contempt for, given its orders to CDC analysts to avoid using the terms science-based and evidence-based. And it was a reminder that in Orwell's dystopia in 1984, there is no word for science, because the empirical method of thought, on which all the scientific achievements of the past were founded, represents an objective reality that threatens the power of Big Brother to determine what truth is. In addition to announcing that it was withdrawing from the Paris Climate Accord, after Syria signed on, the United States was left as the lone country repudiating the global agreement. The Trump administration vowed to terminate President Obama's Clean Power Plan and reverse a ban on offshore oil and gas drilling. Scientists were dismissed from government advisory boards, and plans were made to cut funding for an array of research programs in such fields as biomedicine, environmental science, engineering, and data analysis. The EPA alone was facing proposed cuts from the White House of $2.5 billion from its annual budget, a reduction of more than 23%. In April 2017, the March for Science, organized in Washington to protest the Trump administration's anti-science policies, grew into more than 400 marches in more than 35 nations, participants marching out of solidarity with colleagues in the United States, and also out of concern for the status of science and reason in their own countries. Decisions made by the U.S. government about climate change and other global problems, after all, have a domino effect around the world, affecting joint enterprises and collaborative research, as well as efforts to find international solutions to crises affecting the planet. British scientists worry about how Brexit will affect universities and research institutions in the UK, and the ability of British students to study in Europe. Scientists in countries from Australia to Germany to Mexico worry about the spread of attitudes devaluing science, evidence, and peer review. And doctors in Latin America and Africa worry that fake news about Zika and Ebola are spreading misinformation and fear. Mike McFerrin, a graduate student in glaciology, working in Konjerluswak, a town of 500 in Greenland, told Science magazine that the residents there had practical reasons to worry about climate change because runoff from the ice sheet had partially washed out a local bridge. "I liken the attacks on science to turning off the headlights," he said. "We are driving fast and people don't want to see what's coming up. Scientists, we are the headlights." One of the most harrowing accounts of just how quickly the rule of raison, faith in science, humanism, progress, and liberty, can give way to its very opposite, terror and mass emotion, was laid out by the Austrian writer Stefan Zweig in his 1942 memoir, The World of Yesterday. Zweig witnessed two globe-shaking calamities in his life, World War I, followed by a brief respite, and then the cataclysmic rise of Hitler and descent into World War II. His memoir is an act of bearing witness to how Europe tore itself apart suicidally, twice within decades. The story of the terrible defeat of reason and the wildest triumph of brutality, and a lesson, he hoped, for future generations. Zweig wrote about growing up in a place and time when the miracles of science, the conquest of diseases, the transmission of the human word in a second around the globe, made progress seem inevitable, and even dire problems like poverty no longer seemed insurmountable. An optimism, which may remind some readers of the hopes that surged through the Western world after the fall of the Berlin Wall in 1989, informed his father's generation, Zweig recalled. They honestly believed that the divergences and the boundaries between nations and sects would gradually melt away into a common humanity, and that peace and security, the highest of treasures, would be shared by all mankind. When he was young, Zweig and his friends spent hours hanging out at coffee houses, talking about art and personal concerns. "We had a passion to be the first to discover the latest, the newest, the most extravagant, the unusual." There was a sense of security in those years for the upper and middle classes. One's house was insured against fire and theft, one's field against hail and storm, one's person against accident and sickness. People were slow to recognize the danger Hitler represented. The few among writers who had taken the trouble to read Hitler's book, Zweig writes, ridiculed the bombast of his stilted prose instead of occupying themselves with his program. Newspapers reassured readers that the Nazi movement would collapse in no time, and many assumed that if an anti-Semitic agitator actually did become chancellor, he would, as a matter of course, throw off such vulgarities. Ominous signs were piling up. Groups of menacing young men near the German border preached their gospel to the accompaniment of threats that whoever did not join promptly would have to pay for it later. And the underground cracks and crevices between the classes and races, which the age of conciliation had so laboriously patched up, were breaking open again, and soon widened into abysses and chasms. But the Nazis were careful, Zweig remembers, not to disclose the full extent of their aims right away. They practiced their method carefully. Only a small dose to begin with, then a brief pause. Only a single pill at a time, and then a moment of waiting to observe the effect of its strength, to see whether the public and the world conscience would still digest this dose. And because they were reluctant to abandon their accustomed lives, their daily routines and habits, Zweig wrote, people did not want to believe how rapidly their freedoms were being stolen. People asked what Germany's new leader could possibly put through by force in a state where law was securely anchored, where the majority in Parliament was against him, and where every citizen believed his liberty and equal rights secured by the solemnly affirmed Constitution. This eruption of madness, they told themselves, could not last in the 20th century. 2. The New Culture Wars. The death of objectivity relieves me of the obligation to be right. It demands only that I be interesting. Stanley Fish. In a prescient 2005 article, David Foster Wallace wrote that the proliferation of news outlets, in print, on TV, and online, had created a kaleidoscope of information options. Wallace observed that one of the ironies of this strange media landscape that had given birth to a proliferation of ideological news outlets, including so many on the right, like Fox News and the Rush Limbaugh show, was that it created precisely the kind of relativism that cultural conservatives decry, a kind of epistemic free-for-all in which the truth is wholly a matter of perspective and agenda. Those words were written more than a decade before the election of 2016, and they uncannily predict the post-Trump cultural landscape, where truth increasingly seems to be in the eye of the beholder. Facts are fungible and socially constructed, and we often feel as if we've been transported to an upside-down world where assumptions and alignments in place for decades have suddenly been turned inside out. The Republican Party, once a bastion of Cold War warriors, and Trump, who ran on a law and order platform, shrug off the dangers of Russia's meddling in American elections, and GOP members of Congress talk about secret cabals within the FBI and the Department of Justice. Like some members of the 1960s counterculture, many of these new Republicans reject rationality and science. During the first round of the culture wars, many on the new left rejected Enlightenment ideals as vestiges of old patriarchal and imperialist thinking. Today, such ideals of reason and progress are assailed on the right as part of a liberal plot to undercut traditional values or suspicious signs of egghead Eastern Corridor elitism. For that matter, paranoia about the government has increasingly migrated from the left, which blamed the military-industrial complex for Vietnam, to the right, with alt-right trolls and Republican members of Congress now blaming the so-called deep state for plotting against the president. The Trump campaign depicted itself as an insurgent revolutionary force, battling on behalf of its marginalized constituency and disingenuously using language which strangely echoed that used by radicals in the 1960s. We're trying to disrupt the collusion between the wealthy donors, the large corporations, and the media executives, Trump declared at one rally. And in another, he called for replacing this failed and corrupt political establishment. More ironic still is the populist right's appropriation of postmodernist arguments and its embrace of the philosophical repudiation of objectivity. Schools of thought affiliated for decades with the left, and with the very elite academic circles that Trump and company scorn. Why should we care about these often arcane-sounding arguments from academia? It's safe to say that Trump has never plowed through the works of Derrida, Baudrillard, or Lyotard, if he's even heard of them. And postmodernists are hardly to blame for all the free-floating nihilism abroad in the land, but some dumbed-down corollaries of their thinking have seeped into popular culture and been hijacked by the president's defenders, who want to use its relativistic arguments to excuse his lies, and by right-wingers who want to question evolution or deny the reality of climate change or promote alternative facts. Even Mike Cernovich, the notorious alt-right troll and conspiracy theorist, invoked postmodernism in a 2016 interview with The New Yorker. "Look, I read postmodernist theory in college. If everything is a narrative, then we need alternatives to the dominant narrative," he said, adding, "I don't seem like a guy who reads Lacan, do I?" Since the 1960s, there has been a snowballing loss of faith in institutions and official narratives. Some of this skepticism has been a necessary corrective, a rational response to the calamities of Vietnam and Iraq, to Watergate and the financial crisis of 2008, and to the cultural biases that had long infected everything from the teaching of history in elementary schools to the injustices of the justice system. But the liberating democratization of information made possible by the Internet not only spurred breathtaking innovation and entrepreneurship, it also led to a cascade of misinformation and relativism, as evidenced by today's fake news epidemic. Central to the breakdown of official narratives in academia was the constellation of ideas falling under the broad umbrella of postmodernism, which arrived at American universities in the second half of the 20th century via such French theorists as Foucault and Derrida, whose ideas, in turn, were indebted to the German philosophers Heidegger and Nietzsche. In literature, film, architecture, music, and painting, postmodernist concepts, exploding storytelling traditions and breaking down boundaries between genres and between popular culture and high art, would prove emancipating and, in some cases, transformative, resulting in a wide range of innovative works from artists like Thomas Pynchon, David Bowie, the Coen brothers, Quentin Tarantino, David Lynch, Paul Thomas Anderson, and Frank Gehry. When postmodernist theories were applied to the social sciences and history, however, all sorts of philosophical implications, both intended and unintended, would result, and eventually pinball through our culture. There are many different strands of postmodernism and many different interpretations, but very broadly speaking, postmodernist arguments deny an objective reality existing independently from human perception, contending that knowledge is filtered through the prisms of class, race, gender, and other variables. In rejecting the possibility of an objective reality and substituting the notions of perspective and positioning for the idea of truth, postmodernism enshrined the principle of subjectivity. Language is seen as unreliable and unstable, part of the unbridgeable gap between what is said and what is meant, and even the notion of people acting as fully rational, autonomous individuals is discounted, as each of us is shaped, consciously or unconsciously, by a particular time and culture. Out with the idea of consensus. Out with the view of history as a linear narrative. Out with big universal or transcendent meta-narratives. The Enlightenment, for instance, is dismissed by many postmodernists on the left as a hegemonic or Eurocentric reading of history, aimed at promoting colonialist or capitalistic notions of reason and progress. The Christian narrative of redemption is rejected too, as is the Marxist road to a communist utopia. To some postmodernists, the scholar Christopher Butler observes, even the arguments of scientists can be seen as no more than quasi-narratives which compete with all the others for acceptance. They have no unique or reliable fit to the world, no certain correspondence with reality. They are just another form of fiction. The migration of postmodern ideas from academia to the political mainstream is a reminder of how the culture wars, as the vociferous debates over race, religion, gender, and school curricula were called during the 1980s and 1990s, have mutated in unexpected ways. The terrorist attacks of 9/11 and the financial crisis of 2008, it was thought, had marginalized those debates, and there was hope, during the second term of President Barack Obama, that the culture wars in their most virulent form might be winding down. Healthcare legislation, the Paris Climate Accord, a stabilizing economy after the crash of 2008, same-sex marriage, efforts to address the inequities of the criminal justice system. Although a lot of essential reforms remained to be done, many Americans believed that the country was at least set on a progressive path. In his 2015 book, A War for the Soul of America, the historian Andrew Hartman wrote that the traditionalists who resisted the cultural changes set into motion during the 60s, and identified with normative Americanism of the 1950s, seem to have lost the culture wars of the 1980s and 1990s. By the 21st century, Hartman wrote, a growing majority of Americans now accept and even embrace what at the time seemed like a new nation. In this light, the late 20th century culture wars should be understood as an adjustment period. The nation struggled over cultural change in order to adjust to it. The culture wars compelled Americans, even conservatives, to acknowledge transformations to American life. And although acknowledgement often came in the form of rejection, it was also the first step to resignation, if not outright acceptance. As it turns out, this optimistic assessment was radically premature, much the way that Francis Fukuyama's 1989 essay, The End of History, arguing that with the implosion of Soviet communism, liberal democracy had triumphed and would become the final form of human government, was premature. A Freedom House report concluded that, with populist and nationalist forces making significant gains in democratic states, 2016 marked the 11th consecutive year of decline in global freedom. And in 2017, Fukuyama said he was concerned about a slow erosion of institutions and democratic norms under President Trump. 25 years earlier, he said, he didn't have a sense or a theory about how democracies can go backward, but now realized they clearly can. As for the culture wars, they quickly came roaring back. Hardcore segments of the Republican base, the Tea Party, birthers, right-wing evangelicals, white nationalists, had mobilized against President Obama and his policies. And Trump, as both candidate and president, would pour gasoline on these social and political fractures as a way to both gin up his base and distract attention from his policy failures and many scandals. He exploited the partisan divides in American society, appealing to the fears of white working-class voters worried about a changing world, while giving them scapegoats he selected. Immigrants, African-Americans, women, Muslims, as targets for their anger. It's no coincidence that Russian trolls, working to get Trump elected while trying to undermine faith in the U.S. democratic system, were, at the same time, using fake social media accounts in efforts to further amplify divisions among Americans. For instance, it turned out that Russian trolls used an imposter Facebook account called Heart of Texas to organize a protest called Stop the Islamization of Texas in May 2016, and another imposter Facebook account called United Muslims of America to organize a counter-protest at the same time and place. Some of the most eloquent critics of Trump's politics of fear and division have been conservatives like Steve Schmidt, Nicole Wallace, Joe Scarborough, Jennifer Rubin, Max Boot, David Frum, Bill Kristol, Michael Gerson, and the Republican senators John McCain and Jeff Flake. But most of the GOP rallied behind Trump, rationalizing his lies, his disdain for expertise, his contempt for many of the very ideals America was founded upon. For such Trump enablers, party trumped everything. Morality, national security, fiscal responsibility, common sense, and common decency. In the wake of stories about Trump's alleged affair with the porn star Stormy Daniels, evangelicals came to his defense. Jerry Falwell Jr. said, all these things were years ago. And Tony Perkins, president of the Family Research Council, said he and his supporters were willing to give Trump a pass for his personal behavior. It's an ironic development, given where conservatives stood during the first wave of the culture wars in the 1980s and 1990s. Back then, it was conservatives who promoted themselves as guardians of tradition, expertise, and the rule of law, standing in opposition to what they saw as the decline of reason and a repudiation of Western values. In his 1987 book, The Closing of the American Mind, the political philosophy professor Alan Bloom railed against relativism and condemned 1960s campus protests in which, he said, commitment was understood to be profounder than science, passion than reason. And the scholar Gertrude Himmelfarb warned that the writing and teaching of history had been politicized by a new generation of postmodernists. In viewing the past through the lenses of variables like gender and race, she argued, postmodernists were implying not just that all truths are contingent, but that